Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
New documents reveal the Transport Agency knew maintenance on Auckland Harbour Bridge had contaminated land next to houses, but decided not to tell local people. It found high and rising levels of lead, zinc and a cancer-causing hydrocarbon at the bridge's north end in 2010. The agency's National Environment Manager at the time says it was covered up. Our reporter Phil Pennington's been looking into this.
Well, Susie, what we have is a dozen documents from 2010 to 2013, and these chart how tests found the lead at up to 3.5 times permitted levels, a great deal of zinc, which is not that toxic to people but is to plants and animals, elevated copper, plus the nasty hydrocarbon called BAP at up to 30 times permitted levels. And this is in a small area of council reserve land either side of the bridge's landfall at Te Onawa Pa, which is also known as Stokes Point in Northcote.
Okay. What do we know about where all of this came from?
Well, that BAP hydrocarbon, that's a bit of a mystery, but possibly from contaminated fill dump decades ago. The metals came in part from the bridge's maintenance, the sandblasting for painting. The lead and zinc could have come from the paint. Their levels rose between tests for a consent in 2001 and these tests in 2010, and that's a period of unleaded petrol, so it didn't come from petrol. This was all meant to be controlled under resource consents, but the National Environment Manager at the time, Carl Reller, I've spoken to him, he says the bridge maintenance contractors told him they had not even seen the bridge consent conditions, and they couldn't have met them if they had done. Now, these contamination findings were passed to Auckland Regional Public Health, and in early 2011, it recommended the agency go public and so that they could test local people's gardens. The agency's own lawyers, Susie, they tell it that it faces a range of liability if it delays telling locals. But instead, it cancelled 2 go public dates, and Carl Reller says he was blocked from ever going public.
Reller headed the agency's environment management nationally on all the major projects from 2007 to 2014. So what else does he have to say about the bridge's contamination?
Yeah, Reller was in a key position. He's 71 now and retired in Wairarapa. But documents show that time and again, he tried to get the agency to tell the public about the bridge contaminants.
There was a letter drafted. There were fact sheets written. There was consultation internally about how we'd go forward with this. It never happened.
Why not?
Because the people working on the project and in the region resisted engaging the public, even though their consent said that they were required to. I tried at least a half a dozen times to have a review by senior management, but every time I got it on the agenda, it would be pulled off the agenda at the last minute. After getting it knocked back a half a dozen times, I just realized it wasn't going to go anywhere.
Why wasn't it made clear to local people about what was going on?
Well, Carl Reller, he told me that the Auckland Regional Office, he was in an arm wrestle with them, and they repeatedly told him that going public, that it would cause alarm out of proportion to the risk, not just for the local people, but elsewhere. They were worried people living near highways everywhere would be worried about contamination. He says he told them it's a small problem, we can easily fix this, and at the heart of this, people have the right to know, and of course that's what he maintains to this day. He says his long experience at Waka Kotahi was that it did not want to engage the public when there was a real genuine problem that it had caused of contamination, noise or air pollution. He says he saw many, many resource consents over the years, including at the Harbour Bridge, that were being ignored. He's talked of 5,000 consents and 95% of them not being followed. Now, he expects that bridge contamination is still there, that locals still don't know. As for other contamination in that area, the south end of the bridge has also been tested. Similar contaminants found there, but houses aren't so close to that.
And what does the agency have to say?
Well, the Transport Agency, they wouldn't be interviewed, though we asked to hear direct from them on what is an issue of public health. The agency says that portions of the bridge still do have lead-based paint on them, but the risk's reducing over time as that paint is removed and replaced, with, they say, appropriate containment controls in place when that removal takes place over land. It says the bridge has reduced how often repainting is done and reduced dust discharges, and in fact won a national award for this, the agency says, in 2015. Its statement talks about the historical origins of some of this contamination, but it doesn't address what contamination levels are now. It doesn't address the breaking of consent rules, and it doesn't address why it never told local people about it, except for a line at which it says the Auckland Council, as the regulator, determines if the public should be told about contamination.
Hundreds of women with endometriosis say they've been sidelined and left in pain and distress by COVID-19 delays. The condition causes uterine tissue to grow in other parts of the abdomen and can cause extremely painful periods, chronic pain, and organs to fuse to other parts of the body. The organisation Endometriosis New Zealand says it heard from 568 women over the Level 4 lockdown who were desperate after their surgery or appointments were cancelled. It says as many are yet to have care that they need. West Auckland woman Ali Larson still suffers from the condition despite having had a hysterectomy and an ovary removed. She told our health correspondent, Rowan Quinn, she spent two nights in hospital in pain in August, but can't see a specialist immediately.
I finally got an appointment for November, but that was after me ringing numerous of times, going down and seeing them and actually pushing for an appointment with the gynaecologist.
This November appointment, it's really because you've been sort of a squeaky wheel and you've just kept on it. So there must be a lot of other women who are probably just...
I've forgotten. Yeah, I mean, I understand that, like, with COVID and everything, but it's just not fair enough.
Do you think there is still a dismissal of women-specific health problems?
Oh, definitely. Even now, like, even myself now, I still get, like, shrugged off. When I was last at the emergency room at Waitakere, I was very lucky and I had a very understanding doctor who got straight on to the North Shore Gynaecology Department, because obviously my local hospital doesn't have any gynaecology specialists or anyone over this way. But usually they look at me and it's like, this is a quote from a doctor at Waitakere Hospital, your disease is not sexy enough. And it's like, you just, like, what? Like, chronic pain's not sexy enough to be dealt with. That's just ridiculous.
What do you think he meant by that? What was the kind of context?
Oh, because I think in emergency, hence the word emergency, they like to deal with, you know, like people who might be losing a limb. So something more exciting than chronic pain.
Can you describe what it's like, I guess, to live with that chronic pain?
Oh, some days it's tough. Some days you can't even get out of bed. And the days like this morning where I forced myself to actually get out of bed, do a little bit of yoga and a little bit of housework, I mean, it's just so exhausting, physically and mentally. Your mind is forever battling your body, you know, like your mind might be capable, but then your body's not. And it's just a constant daily struggle.
That's endometriosis patient Ali Larson. The Waitemata DHB, where she is a patient, says she has received extensive treatment over the last 4 years and it has reached out to her over her recent concerns.
We can go now to Labour leader Jacinda Ardern, who is on the line. Kia ora.
Morena.
Clearly very tragic circumstances surrounding the death of Matthew Ratana. Is there any involvement from New Zealand House at all regarding funeral services, anything like that, as this is clearly going to be considered in the next few days?
I know the Police Commissioner, Andy Costa, has been in direct touch with his counterpart in the UK over the really tragic loss of a police officer who did have links to New Zealand as well, and obviously family here as well as those police family links. I haven't, Susie, been updated this morning on whether or not that contact over acknowledging him or involvement of New Zealand House, but that's certainly something I will be checking in on this morning.
Yeah, as for family of Matthew Ratana who may want to make their way to the UK for the funeral, is that something that the New Zealand government is going to be able to help expedite?
Well, of course, travel and movement over to the UK is possible, and quarantine-free as well. Obviously, on return, they would need to come through our system, but I don't foresee there being any any barriers to their travel to the UK. In previous cases, we've had to cross the we have provided consular assistance with flights should there be any issues, and we would do exactly the same here.
If they had to come back in quarantine, would they have to pay for it?
This would almost certainly fall into the category of humanitarian reasons and special exemptions.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the poll which came out yesterday, looking like Labour could govern alone. Unlikely under MMP is a situation, but if that was the situation you were faced with the day of the night of the election, would you or would you go into coalition with a partner to get a bigger majority?
Yeah, two things there. That's not a prospect I've entertained. That's just not been something that MMP elections have delivered, and we're certainly not complacent, so we're not taking for granted an outcome like that. More generally though, Susie, regardless of what could potentially be delivered after the election, my way of governing over the last 3 years has been to try and build consensus over particularly large reforms that we want to endure, regardless of whether we needed those numbers. So for instance, the child poverty legislation or even the Zero Carbon Act, we worked hard to try and build consensus with the National Party despite not needing those numbers. And that's because I think that means that we get a bit of longevity out of those changes.
Nonetheless, though, it looks like your most likely partner, I suppose, would be the Greens. Is there anyone else who seems to be polling above that 5% threshold that you'd consider working with?
Well, obviously, at the moment, those that are polling above have been the Greens, obviously the National Party ACT, and referred to the parties that we can work with. They've been the ones we've worked with over the last 3 years. And no, I wouldn't entertain any other party in that mix I've just listed.
OK, let's talk a little bit about child poverty. The government promised to lift 100,000 children out of poverty by this year. That was set out in 2017 in the policy announcements. How many children have been lifted out of poverty?
We've set our targets of wanting to reduce the number of kids in poverty. And again, Susie, not to get into the weeds on this, we've set a number of measures, not just one. So we've material deprivation, income measures. We set those targets as part of our child reduction,
yep.
Poverty reduction.
And how many have been lifted out of poverty, Prime Minister?
And we're on track. So far, we know, and this is only from the 2018, we've lifted out 18,000. But our changes in total are estimated to lift out between 50 and 74,000. There's a lag in how much we can measure. We're having to run from estimates of the impact we've made rather than the real data.
Sure. But nonetheless, you wanted to lift out 100,000. You maybe can't say it definitively because of the data, but are you even in the ballpark for that?
Well, as I've said, the changes just from the families package were due to lift out between 50 and 74,000. That was before we increased the winter energy payment and before the increase in the benefit payment as well. So we as yet, getting an insight into the difference that those policies have made is going to take a bit more time. But I am confident that we've made a big difference there. COVID-19, however, is likely to have provided a setback. And so I have not yet, however, said that we should revise our targets. I want to keep that ambition because actually in these difficult economic times, we need to maintain that ambition, not let it see it fall away.
Children's Commissioner Judge Andrew Beecroft says there is a large group of children missing out. 10 to 15% of children in demonstrable material disadvantage. That's 150,000 children. He says significantly lifting the incomes of the poorest family is the way to fix this. So will you raise benefits?
Well, we have. And
will you raise benefits further?
We already have. We've also said now what we want to move to. For instance, increasing the support we provide, for instance, on those who are on sole parent benefits so that they can enter into training, enter into higher education whilst having support for childcare and others. Those are the things in the long term make a difference to the incomes of those families. And Susie, what I would also say is that in total, some people fall back solely on the main benefit increases. if you take the combination of what we've done with the Best Start payment, with the winter energy payment, with the increase, the family tax credit, a sole parent, a large proportion of sole parents are getting an extra more than $100 a week because of those changes.
Yeah, but nonetheless, Prime Minister, it was your working group in welfare that came up with the data of 47% was how much benefits needed to be raised by. That was your own investigation. So when are you? Why is it that this is so politically toxic to say, yep, we're going to raise benefits by getting on for 50%?
I've just explained to you how we have seen an increase for sole parents of, in most cases, more than $100 a week. That is the most significant increase that we've seen in New Zealand in decades. The Children's Commissioner himself acknowledges what a difference that we've made as a government on child poverty issues. And actually, I'm really proud of that, Susie. That is making a difference to families. We already said at the moment that the working group on welfare came out with their recommendations, a number of which we've progressed, that we wouldn't be able to do everything that they've suggested all at once. It's just not feasible. They were suggesting 40% increases in one go. We just couldn't do it, but we've made significant changes that I am proud of.
So would you want to see that 47% raised, however you do it, during the next term?
Well, we've already said what our priorities are, because we actually, after even that report came out, have increased general benefits, along with the other changes I've listed. We've said our next priorities are other things that they actually suggested. They said reinstate the training incentive allowance. We've pledged to do that. They've said keep moving on abatement so that people can keep a bit more of what they earn part-time. Well, that incentivises and encourages people into the workplace where they also might receive government support. We said we want to move on that as well, and that we'll keep moving on those recommendations as we're able to, but those are our two priorities.
So just to clarify, by the end of another term, should you get another term, would you want to have achieved a lift of 47% in benefits?
We will not achieve that lift in a three-year term. However, I do want to keep making incremental progress, and that 47% doesn't take into account, for instance, the extra $100 a week we're seeing for those sole parents.
Many of those in this situation, in poverty, are Māori. You had your first TV debate against Judith Collins last week. Māori not mentioned at all. Is that an indication that, far from being at the centre of policy, Māori are an afterthought or perhaps a bolt-on?
I totally reject that.
Why?
Simply because the list of achievements that we have in that area, again, I stand by absolutely. You know, whether it's our $230 million investment in rebuilding Kohangareo, our investment in Te Reo Māori revitalisation, the support we've seen for whānau ora, which is making a huge difference and must be supported to continue to make a difference, right through to the investment that we're making in papakāinga housing and Māori employment initiatives, and the basic decision to teach New Zealand history in schools. I have a record I would happily debate with the Leader of the Opposition in this area. And if a dedicated subject were given to that in debate, I would absolutely welcome it.
Thank you very much. That is Labour Leader Jacinda Ardern. A second arrest has been made following the death of New Zealand-born policeman Matthew Ratana in London. Sergeant Ratana was shot and killed on Friday by a handcuffed suspect who was in custody. The Metropolitan Police previously said the shooting wasn't being treated as terror-related, but it's believed the suspect, alleged to have shot Mr. Ratana, was known to counter-terror police. During a wreath-laying ceremony to mark National Police Memorial Day, Metropolitan Police Chief Cressida Dick acknowledged Mr. Ratana's service as a proud policeman and sportsman.
People in Croydon and Hackney, for example, you know, remember him so fondly as a really good police officer who, you know, could be very firm and certainly was, you know, very good at investigating crime and arresting people and dealing with antisocial behaviour and that kind of thing, but also was involved in supporting people and helping young people get away from crime. You know, a really rounded character.
A little earlier, I spoke with BBC London radio reporter Sonia Jessop, who told me Mr. Ratana was being widely mourned.
There have been so many warm words and tributes for him. It's actually National Police Memorial Day today, when officers who lost their lives in the line of duty are remembered. And we did hear from Met Police Commissioner Dame Cressida Dick, and she said he was a proud Kiwi. She said Matt was an extraordinary person. He had a wonderful personality. He was very good at his job. And Prince Charles also paid his respects at the service. He said Sergeant Rutner's death was the latest heartbreaking evidence of the risks that police face, because he is the eighth police officer in the UK to be shot dead in the last 20 years. I've also been speaking to many of Sergeant Rutner's friends today at East Grinstead Rugby Club, which is a club in West Sussex, so a couple of hours south of London, where he was head coach. And they had a minute silence there. They flew the New Zealand flag and also an All Blacks rugby team flag to honour his roots. And everyone I spoke to just seems to have been incredibly touched by him. Everyone's got a story about how he would make time for them. He loved his rugby. He was so passionate about that. And they just said they've had messages of support from across the world. And even though he was here in London for such a long time, you do get the idea he was so proud of his roots, a proud Kiwi.
Just remind us what happened on Friday. Is it any clearer how someone apparently with his hands behind his back was able to shoot a police officer?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many questions about that. What we know is that a suspect is now being named this evening, as 23-year-old Louis DeZoiza. He was arrested for an alleged drug offence and possession of ammunition, and he was handcuffed, as you say, with his hands behind his back. That's what we've been told by the police watchdog, the IOPC. The officers were preparing to search him, they said, using a metal detector when the shots were fired. And Sergeant Rutner was then shot in the chest, taken to hospital. He later died. But clearly so many questions about how that could have happened and indeed why it happened. What was the motive? The suspect is thought then shot himself, and he is still in a critical condition in hospital. Officers haven't yet been able to speak to him. And I'm told the police have CCTV from the custody suite and also body-worn video from officers. They're going to be looking through all that, of course, very closely.
The suspect, was he known to police? Was there any terrorism link here?
Well, the police have said that the shooting was not terror-related. It is believed, however, that he was known to counter-terrorism police. He had been referred to something called the PREVENT programme, which is a programme that the government runs. It's aimed at stopping people joining extremist groups and carrying out terrorist activities.
And that is BBC London's Sonia Jessop.
Immigration says three German yachties showed a blatant disregard for the country's laws when they sailed into New Zealand despite having their border application declined. They had applied for a border exemption from the Ministry of Health, but it was refused. They continued their journey anyway, and on Friday the trio sailed into Opua in the Bay of Islands, where they were met by customs officials and detained. Peter Elms is Immigration New Zealand's Border and Visa Operations Manager. He joins us now. Morena.
Morena, Colin.
You've taken a very tough approach with this. Why is it? Are you trying to set a bit of an example here?
Well, I think the response matches the severity of the action, in fairness. I think you've already outlined there that New Zealand's got border controls, border restrictions in place for a very good reason. And these three individuals deliberately breached those border restrictions. So, at the end of the day, every action's got a consequence, and the consequence for these guys is pretty severe.
The context of this is that they were coming here because there is this fear for many sailors in the Pacific at the moment, worried about the hurricane season, and they're heading to places like New Zealand and Australia to get away from that, but they need time. They need 2 or 3 weeks or so to do that. Are you getting more of these requests?
Well, clearly, there's a number of yachties out in the South Pacific. There's anywhere between 300 and 500 yachts out there. And ordinarily, pre-COVID days, you'd expect those yachties to go to Australia or New Zealand. And the reason for that is that the hurricane season comes in, and actually they have difficulty getting insurance to stay in the South Pacific. So it's more of an economic reason for yachties.
Yes, but I mean, if there was to be a series of hurricanes, what would you do then? I mean, surely there's humanitarian grounds for taking these people, because I should point out they had done effectively 14 days quarantine, hadn't they? They weren't coming here as a risk.
Well, it was up to the individuals to sort their own affairs out. I mean, let's face it, the border restrictions have been in place for 6 months now, so there's no lack of time for them to be able to organise their own affairs. They could have moored their boat up. They could have put the boat on land. They could have travelled back from the Pacific back to Germany.
Sure. Is there a balance, though? I mean, if you do start seeing hurricanes, for example, and people are in clear distress, there must be a threshold at which point you would accept people?
Well, we have the border restrictions in place, do have a humanitarian aspect to them, absolutely, and we do allow people in for humanitarian circumstances, but the threshold, quite rightly, is high. And so if people were certainly in danger of bodily injury and death, then absolutely New Zealand would go above and beyond to make sure that those people are safe. But what we're saying here is that for the boaters that are moored up in the South Pacific, New Zealand is not your answer. New Zealand's not the destination to sail to. You need to sort your affairs out in the South Pacific and make your way home to your home countries from there.
Peter Elms from Immigration New Zealand.
Work is going on behind the scenes to progress plans for privately run pay-as-you-go managed isolation hotels, with Auckland's Economic Development Agency taking the lead. Auckland Tourism Events and Economic Development, ATED, is in talks with government officials about opening up the border to critical skilled workers who would pay to stay in separate isolation hotels to returning Kiwis. This week, the agency is gathering leaders from different sectors to start work on a joint proposal. Amy Williams reports.
In normal times, Auckland is the gateway to New Zealand. That screeched to a halt with the border closure. As the country heads into a recession, many sectors are urging the government to open the borders to more skilled workers, including the film industry. Screen Time Chief Executive Philly DeLacy says although the company is busy now, missed opportunities due to border closures have cost her tens of millions of dollars and hundreds of local jobs.
We've missed out on a lot of work too because of the inability to bring anyone into New Zealand. A lot of money, a significant injection of money into New Zealand as well, and that's been endlessly frustrating.
Ms. DeLacy says she lost one production to Ireland because immigration wouldn't let two film executives into New Zealand. She's part of a multi-sector group working with ATED to come up with a joint plan for private managed isolation to open the border to critical workers. The group will meet for the first time this week. ATED Chief Executive Nick Hill says talks have also begun with government officials.
We are working in a very practical, detailed way with various groups in Auckland to work with officials in Wellington to help inform the flow of advice that then goes through to the government. And these are not easy issues.
Mr. Hill says they hope to take a proposal to policymakers after the general election. He says ATED is involved because it's an economic crisis Auckland needs to solve.
It's not an ideological debate. It's a question of designing solutions in a world that's changing all the time and, you know, learning more and coming up with things that will work.
RNZ recently revealed the private sector wanted to set up privately run managed isolation hotels for wealthy tourists and skilled workers, and that Auckland University has a proposal to provide managed isolation for international students at its hostels. The construction sector is also facing major skills shortages. The Construction Strategy Group estimated there would be over 50,000 jobs to fill in the 5 years to 2021. Executive Director Julian Lays says it makes sense to have a cross-industry plan for private managed isolation.
We are seeing a real bottleneck, particularly where that expertise is needed on some projects, including some of the shovel-ready work. So both public and private sector projects need those people, and we are not getting them.
Those in the film industry are concerned Hollywood may stop looking to New Zealand as a destination for shoots if the border does not open to more skilled workers. Philly DeLacy says the show must go on.
There has got to be some way that we can safely manage private quarantine into New Zealand so that in any industry, if someone is wanting to spend in New Zealand but that requires bringing one or two or three people into New Zealand, it can happen.
Through Screen Time, she's about to apply to bring in two film industry professionals from the US.
I hope that by now maybe the processes are a bit more under control, maybe the criteria has been sort of smoothed out, but I'm just nervous because, you know, I don't want to lose another production because I can't get two people into New Zealand.
The government has rejected the idea of privately run managed isolation facilities in the short term. But ATEED and private companies are determined to carry on pressing their case. For Morning Report, Amy Williams.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.